Hey, welcome back to another episode of Beyond the Spotlight. This is the podcast that'll take you behind the scenes to talk with the unsung heroes who are out there working in the trenches of the music, theater, and TV worlds. Happy springtime. It is the 21st, or later, if you're listening later. It is finally getting warmer. The days are getting longer. And if it's a day of the calendar ending in a one, it means a new episode of Beyond the Spotlight. That's what we try to do, is the 1st, 11th, and 21st of every month. So you can look for new episodes on those days. This one's a good one. You know, I have just been so fortunate to get some really great guests recently. Again, a big shout out to David 51 Norman for steering a bunch of folks my way and being very gracious in that regard. Not only just a lot of people, but a lot of really great people. And I have learned a lot. I have had great conversations. I feel like I know these people much better now. And hopefully after the interview, you will as well. Paul has just an amazing career. And I know I say that a lot, but you know, this is no exception. He's spent over 40 years in touring, in artist management. The list of names is just ridiculous of people that he's worked with. I think I go into them in the beginning of the actual interview, but I wanted to just throw some more out here in case I didn't happen to cover them in that interview. I mean, we're talking all the way back in the late 70s here with Styx, and then we're into the 80s with Barry White, Chicago, David Sanborn, Psychedelic Furs, Barry Manilow, Fiona Apple, Chris Isaac, Lisa Stansfield, 10,000 Maniacs, Christopher Cross, Cowboy Junkies, Bonnie Raitt. I mean, we're only up to the 2000s here so far. Mark Cohn, My Morning Jacket, Nickel Creek, Punch Brothers, The Wallflowers, James Taylor, Roseanne Cash, Bruce Hornsby, Suzanne Vega, Al Jarreau, Ella Fitzgerald, Joan Baez. I mean, is there any? I think it would be shorter to just list who he hasn't worked with, because it's amazing. And Paul is the coolest guy. I mean, he's so informative and knowledgeable and just very intelligent. And it was a joy to talk to him and kind of get a peek into his career and his life. Hopefully you will enjoy that as well. I actually talked with Paul back on December 18th of 2020. So it's been a little bit since we actually did the interview, but timing worked out that we could do it then. And he joined us from his place in New York City. And it's just a thrill to talk to people like this who just have so much to share about the business and about their experiences. So I hope you enjoy it half as much as I did doing the interview and editing it and listening to it over and over. I just had a smile on my face. So we'll get into the interview in a second. Just want to remind everybody, you can get in touch with us if you have suggestions for guests or you have comments about the show. You can reach us at our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/ Beyond the Spotlight Podcast. We're also on Instagram at Beyond the Spotlight Podcast. And email is beyondthespotlightpodcast@gmail.com. And finally, if you feel the urge to help support the show in some small way, either a one-time donation or an ongoing monthly contribution, that would be greatly appreciated. As of now, we've got a couple people actually doing that on a regular monthly basis, which is very much appreciated. But you can do that by going to our main page, which is beyondthespotlightpodcast.com. And up in the upper right-hand corner, there are some icons for our social media outlets. And also there's an icon there that's like a coin with a little heart on it. And if you click on that, that'll take you to our PayPal, where you can set up any kind of a donation or contribution there. Again, very much appreciated if you're able to do that. If not, no worries. Let's get into the show and let's talk with Paul Dalen. Today we have someone who has an amazing resume. He's worked as a production manager, tour manager, front of house engineer, numerous festivals, worked for a while for Bill Graham at the Fillmore as a production manager. Just a ton of stuff here, so it's going to be a good one. So hang on, and welcome to the show, Mr. Paul Dalen.
Happy to be here. Wow, I'm exhausted just hearing about that. it's funny. There are things that occasionally I forget. It's like, I did do that, didn't I? So anyway, very happy to be here and to join you, John.
Thanks a lot. Where do we even begin? This is just a crazy list of things, and clearly there's got to be some stories in there, and we'll get to those in a minute. But let's kind of back up and look at how did you get into the business to begin with? Did you come from like a musical family, or were you interested in it from that angle, or how did you get into it?
Sure. Well, I think I'm a little older than most of the guests that you've had on the podcast. And the only reason I mention that and why I think it's relevant to your question is that I come from an era where music, popular music, was a little bit more central and important to a young person's life than maybe it has become. Meaning, I come from the era of the Beatles. I watched the Beatles on Ed Sullivan Live. It left a deep and lifelong impression. My parents, God bless them, when I was in second grade, took me to see the Beatles live in Kansas City, Missouri. That was my first gig. So, I mean, it certainly isn't inevitable, but music was just always was a huge part of my life. And in high school, I played guitar. I mean, going back before high school, but, you know, I always self-identified as a musician. And out of high school, I was a musician, and I was in a local band in Lawrence, Kansas. I grew up in Kansas City, but then moved to Lawrence. And eventually came to the conclusion that I really didn't have the chops or the dedication to make it as a musician. So while I, at least ostensibly, tried to figure out what I was really going to do, I started working on the tech side and decided that I liked it very, very much. I was still able to be involved in music. I loved live shows. I still love live shows. So that's kind of the short version. One thing led to another after that.
Yeah, yeah. Were your parents musical? Did they play anything or sing or do anything like that?
My parents loved music, and my mom did sing when she was younger. So there was music around the house, but it wouldn't be accurate to say that I come from some kind of musical lineage or a musical background.
Yeah, yeah. Because I find that, you know, most people that end up in music or in the technical side of music, you know, do come from at least a household where music was played and appreciated a lot.
I think appreciated is very much the word, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and valued. And like you said, to your point earlier, I don't think that's as much the case anymore. You know, I'm probably not too far behind you in age or close to it. And that was a very cultural thing to listen to music with members of your family, whether it was your siblings or, you know, I had three older brothers who, you know, in the early, well, even late 60s, early 70s were turning me on to, you know, albums that they had and, you know, the Eagles or Black Sabbath or Santana or, you know, whatever it was, Frank Zappa. And we, you know, you listen to those things and it was like finding treasure, like, oh my gosh, I can't believe this is out there and I didn't know about it. And you would just play the LPs over and over and over and listen to stuff. And, you know, I remember learning guitar solos off of Black Magic Woman with a 33 record vinyl on a big console stereo, you know, lifting the needle up over and over, trying to hear that same lick over and over.
And albums could find their way into our lives in a profound and meaningful way. And I'm not waxing nostalgic or criticizing at all. This isn't like, okay, boomer time to, you know, come down on the way people engage with music now. But I just remember an entire summer where all I did was listen to Harvest by Neil Young. It's like, I'm not sure if I ever took it off my turntable. Yeah. And then another period where I listened to Tribute to Jack Johnson by Miles Davis. It's like I was just consumed by that bit of music. You know, it was just a different time. There was less music, there were gatekeepers, genres were less important, I think. So yeah, just a different time, that's all.
Sure. Well, in the whole experience around getting new recordings was different then. I mean, you went to a record store, you know, you had to go and seek out the music. You couldn't just sit at a computer and have it come to you, or an iPhone or whatever. You had to go actively look for it, buy it, take it home. You know, you unwrapped it and you had that smell of the vinyl coming out of there, and you'd open it up and you'd look at the liner notes, and you'd listen to it while you read and looked at the pictures. And yeah, it was a
whole experience. The liner notes are a great point, John. I mean, I became one of those record geeks, one of those vinyl geeks as a kid, where I knew addresses and names of studio musicians and recording studios and art directors and all sorts of things, because I'd see those names on my favorite recordings, and I'd want to know more about those people, who they were, what they did, how they did what they did, and how they got to where they were.
Yeah. And then I think I was similar. I would see, you know, on an album that I loved, I would see names of certain players, and then, you know, I would happen to stumble on another album sometime, and there's that same guy, or, you know, the same group of people. And so then I would start to seek out more things with them on there, knowing that, you know, those were things that I already loved. And so it was kind of my Spotify or whatever, you know, in a sense, that I was able to kind of expand my listening, not to diminish the music of today or the experience of music today. But I think, you know, there were less distractions, there was less things fighting for your attention in those days, and music was an active experience rather than something passive where you're doing it while you're, you know, washing the dishes or watching television or whatever.
And less competition for what little expendable income a preteen would have as well.
Sure.
It's like if I wanted to splurge or buy something that was of interest to me, it was a record. I mean, that was it. That's what I had available to me. And luckily that resonated with me, so I was happy to do that.
Yeah. So you got bit by the music bug early on and played in bands and played music. How did that, you know, so you started to get into the tech part of it as a little bit of frustration from not being at the level that you wanted to be musically. And so you started to do that. How did you get, like, what was your first major a gig or tour that you did?
In retrospect, it was incredibly haphazard and without any kind of forethought whatsoever. Like I said, the band I was in broke up. I was, I don't know, 21 years old or something like that. Mm-hmm. The folks that managed the band that I was in managed one other band, and it was the only band in Kansas City that had a recording contract. And it was a group that was signed to CBS called Morning Star from Kansas City. And Morning Star had this slot opening for Styx, like in, I don't know, 1978 or something. And because, you know how it is in local bands or smaller bands, everybody in the band takes on certain responsibilities. And somehow I had evolved into the band member that kind of learned about audio, learned a little bit about sound, and, you know, bought our first 6-channel Tapco mixer. And, you know, it was of that era.
Yeah.
And this is a beautiful thing, because I had no idea how little I knew, when this band Morningstar went on tour with Styx, opening in arenas, and the managers said, "Hey, we need a sound engineer. Would you be interested in doing that?" I was like, "Sure," without any consideration of the fact that I had no idea how to do that, how it might work, how totally unqualified I was. So there was a certain fearlessness and a certain, maybe hubris, but at any rate, more just kind of like I was just ignorant. And I went and did it, and I enjoyed it. And again, kind of one thing led to another. So I established this career as a sound engineer and a tour manager. Shortly thereafter, got hired by the folks that managed Styx, also managed Robin Trower. So my first real gig, so to speak, was being Robin Trower's guitar roadie in 1979.
Oh, wow.
I then got hired by Styx to be the second guitar tech underneath Rocco Reedy. Rocco went on to work for a million people, but was U2's stage manager for, I don't know, 30 years or something.
Wow.
And did that, went back to Kansas City, went back into audio, because even though this foray into backline was super helpful and gave me an opportunity to see so much on this giant tour and learn so much, and I was very curious about everything that was happening around me, so I paid attention to everything and asked lots of questions. Yeah. I went back into audio and tour management And then eventually that kind of morphed into being successful enough that I could kind of pick one or the other. And I became a front of house engineer and did that with a certain amount of success for a pretty long time. I mean, like 20 or 25 years, I was kind of just a front of house engineer.
Mm-hmm.
That was great.
Yeah. Well, and it was a whole different world technically back then for front of house or for the whole system in general, because, you know, there were no digital consoles at that point. There were no, you know, plug-in servers that you used on a show.
No line array.
Yeah, no line array, no, you know, Cat 5, no, you know, all that stuff.
I mean, the most sophisticated testing device or measuring device we had was a handheld third octave analyzer.
Yeah.
An RTA, and then maybe a FET or an FFT that none of us really, I mean, few of us really knew how to operate or how to interpret the data we were being given. So yeah, it was a different time.
But yet the music flourished and people loved the shows. I mean, it's a great case of, you know, doing something really remarkable despite the technology or in spite of the technology. You know, because now no one has an excuse to have a bad sounding show, really. I mean, you've got the tools, there's so many things that can help you do the job better. So if you have a bad sounding show, shame on you. It's really, you know, but in those days you had a lot of things to fight against and overcome just to get kind of to the breaking point or the starting point that a lot of people start at now. So
I would never suggest that I'm not obsessed with live audio, but the worst sounding, most poorly deployed line array system that I encounter today sounds better than probably 80% of the PAs that I mixed on for the majority of my career as front of house engineer. So,
well, I believe it.
I love that aspect of it. That it's really quite common to go to a live show and go, wow, that sounded amazing. And some of my peers from that era who have, you know, have remained in audio and have done well through all this. It's just a joy to hear them and see what they've done. I mean, this band that I worked for in Kansas City, I was the front of house engineer. The monitors engineer was this kid named Robert Scoville. Robert's done pretty well for himself as a front of house engineer. Brad Maddox was one of my system techs. John Osterin was one of my system techs. These are people at the forefront of live audio these days, and it's just a joy to hear what they and so many of their peers are capable of doing with all this great technology.
Yeah. And that's the key is, you know, to be able to use it well and not just use it as a crutch, but to actually take it as far as it can go and maximize the experience. Tell us kind of a day in the life, you know, obviously you've had several different hats and different tours and things over the years. And so there's not an average day in the life, but you know, when you're out as, let's say, a front of house mixer, what's kind of your day in terms of your schedule? Just, you know, kind of a high level overview.
I think it might be, if you don't mind, if I can just hijack that question slightly. I mean, because I really am primarily a tour manager and have been for the past few years. I hope that might be more relevant. Yeah. It's certainly more in the forefront of my mind and more kind of ingrained into my DNA of what I do now. You know, you've had enough people on your podcast that are tour managers that hopefully listeners have at least a cursory understanding of what we do, although many of us do it slightly differently. And that's why we're, at least in theory, why we might get a gig or not get a gig because of how we approach something.
Mm-hmm.
I like to think of myself as highly organized and meticulous. But having said that, one of the key assets of being a successful tour manager is being flexible. So for me, there's this never-ending balance of trying to be hyper-vigilant, which I think is really an accurate description of contemplating every possible eventuality and outcome, and at least having something in my back pocket about how I will deal with that, navigate it, overcome it, depending on how severe it is, in conjunction with unexpected things happen all the time. Right. Most of the artists I work with are mature and have established routines and are sane and sensible people. So a lot of the tours that I do are, you know, pretty established in terms of the daily schedule. So because I've done a lot of work in the past 5 years with Bonnie Raitt, I can tell you on that tour, for example, we have one bus for a band and the artist and myself. We have hotels 7 nights a week. So we go to hotels no matter what time we arrive in a city. So I wake up in the morning and I start looking at well, that's not true. I don't start looking. I dig into the day ahead of me. So that might be having some contact with the hotel that we're currently in about what lies ahead. Hey, just a reminder, here's what time we're checking out. We need assistance with baggage at this time. Please don't forget that you need to clear the valet parking in front of the hotel because our bus is rolling in at 2:30 to pick us up, and just kind of deal with all those hotel things. I always blow in a call to the production manager. In the case of Bonnie, it's Derek Williams, who's just an astonishingly accomplished and competent and well-organized production manager. Check in with him. How's it going? Anything I need to know? Anything I need to be aware of? Because on many of the tours that I do, at the level I do, I'm also the tour accountant. I'll be looking at ticket sales, reviewing guest lists to see where we are, if there's comp tickets that I can release to put back on sale. That happens. Looking ahead, being mindful of what the next few days have in store, advancing the following hotel. Hi, reminder, we're getting in tonight at 3 a.m., you know, let's go over all the things we've already advanced that you're already aware of, but just make sure nothing has fallen through the cracks.
Right.
And like that. So that's kind of a broad strokes view of the things I'm dealing with before I leave the hotel. And then, if people are interested, upon arrival at the venue, there's guest list, there's pre-settlement, meaning doing all the stuff before we actually have all the final expenses and the final ticket sales to get my spreadsheets in order, make sure that's all dialed in. Again, release any comp tickets that we might not need, make sure everything is as it should be, make sure that everybody's duly informed and knows what's going on and that everybody, you know, in the broadest sense, is doing okay. Because a lot of being a tour manager is facilitating comfort, ease, so that the artist or artists can do what they're supposed to do, which is put on a great show, which is why we're all there. And that's why patrons come and pay money. So just trying to make sure that everything is going as it should.
Yeah. You're taking away all those stressors from the artist and the band and the crew, essentially, that, you know, would otherwise distract them from giving their best show and focusing their energies on what they are there to do. And making it as smooth as possible for them
trying
to do their job.
Yes, indeed.
Well, and that's a critical thing. I mean, again, I don't think most people really value your position as much as it should be, because, you know, they go to the show, they see sound people, they see, you know, riggers, they see lighting people or whatever, but they don't always see the management side of it or the you know, things happening off venue or you know, days in advance. So they don't really think about those things. They don't appreciate what's going on. But, you know, just something like you said, as small as, hey, make sure the valet parking is cleared out at 2:30 because the bus is pulling in. I mean, that obviously is something that is important, because if that doesn't happen, then you're waiting and you get off schedule and then things get more stressful. And
or you've got artists walking through traffic. Get into the bus.
Yeah.
I mean, back to your previous point, any music patron who's interested in what I do and what my peers and colleagues do, that's great. But really, we're supposed to be invisible. I mean, the whole idea is to remain behind the scenes and facilitate and remove any points of friction so that when a patron who's paid their hard-earned money to come see a show gets the most valuable, whatever that means to the fan, the most valuable experience they possibly can. They, you know, people come to be entertained, to enjoy. Well, people come for lots of reasons, but, you know, to be entertained, hear music, get a break, whatever. we're there to make that happen. That's what it's all about.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's been said about multiple jobs or careers that if you do your job well, no one should notice. And it's only when things go off the rails that people are aware of your presence, you know,
yes,
whether
indeed.
It's a tour manager or, you know, a film editor, let's say, you know, if they do their job very well, it should be seamless. And you should yeah. never think as you're watching a film, oh, that was a strange cut there.
Yes. You know, seamless or additive, just like, mm-hmm. you know, behind the scenes adding to the overall impact of what the artist is trying to convey.
Yeah. Obviously, in your 40 plus years of doing this, you've had to have a couple of pretty wild experiences or some stories that you can share in terms of, you know, either things that kind of went off the rails or things that just went really, really well and you had a
sure.
really great experience or just something that kind of give us a little, throw us
and
a little
some
bone.
Things that I can't share.
Well, yeah, I'm sure there's
but I'll focus on the ones that I can. I spent
yeah.
a period starting maybe 10 years ago when I really got back into live events more earnestly. And what I mean by that, to just backtrack for a moment, is that at one point I retired from touring. I lived in San Francisco. I went to work for Bell Graham Presents. I was the production manager at the Fillmore in the Warfield. I was no longer touring. Mm-hmm. I worked there for about 3 or 4 years. And in 1999 or 2000, I moved to New York and I actually went into artist management. So I worked for a large management company that had just an amazingly stellar artist roster that included, you know, people that might be less well known, but highly regarded like Joe Henry, but also included artists like David Bowie and David Byrne. And I did that for a few years and then started my own management company. And also had just a great roster of amazing artists like Jill Sobule and Juana Molina, Jim White, the Rosebuds briefly, a bunch of really great artists. And I also managed some record producers. So when I went back into the live event space, my entree into that was starting to do music festivals in the summer. I was employed by a very old friend of mine named Haddon Hipsley, who was the production manager for Phish for many, many years. And when Bonnaroo started and they needed somebody to look after the production, they thought, oh, that guy Haddon, he's done a lot of oddball outdoor festival sites, let's get him involved. Mm-hmm. And he parlayed that into a rather successful business, being the head of production at festivals. So Haddon approached me, again, maybe 10 years ago, and asked if I'd be interested in being a stage manager at Bonnaroo. I think that was the first thing I did for him. And that led to 5 or 6 summer seasons where I stage managed a number of festivals. And because of the nature of those events, meaning outdoors, so there's weather, there's sun, lots of artists in one day, lots of mm-hmm. unpredictable factors.
Yeah.
There were a lot of dramatic things that happened and can happen and continue to happen. And certainly not all of them have been bad. But I mean, at one point, I went back and looked at the previous years and counted. I was involved in the evacuation of like 6 festivals in 4 years, always because of weather. But, you know, it's something you don't really expect to have happen. And some of them were amazingly successful. There's a story of we had to stop Sam Smith in the middle of his show at Forecastle in Louisville a number of years ago, just as a storm was bearing down on us. And the site got torn to bits. I mean, it really got beat up. And I called my wife that night after things settled down and I went, this festival is over. I mean, I'll be home in a couple of days after we tear this thing down, but it is over. There is no way we're going to get this thing back into shape. And lo and behold, we did. And the show went on as scheduled the following day.
Wow.
So there have been some amazing things that have happened. I had a short break in touring where this last year, right before we shut down, because of my relationship with Punch Brothers mm-hmm. and Punch Brothers management, specifically Jason and Eric, I was enlisted to go to work at Live From Here, the radio show, the NPR radio show, which is what Prairie Home Companion became,
right?
And that Chris was the host of.
Yeah.
And that was at Town Hall, so it was a non-touring position. But week in and week out, the music was just like, it was unbelievable, the stuff that I heard every week. Yeah. And the amount of music that Chris and the band just like chewed their way through, always successfully.
Yeah. He is amazing.
There's lots and lots of stories. In recent years, those are a few things. But certainly touring with Bonnie Raitt and getting to listen to her sing every night is never gets old. Bonnie's been on tour a lot with James Taylor lately. That never gets old.
Oh,
I was fortunate enough to do some work last year with My Morning Jacket. That's a thrill. I mean, a whole different thing musically.
Right.
But holy crap. I mean, if you've ever seen a Jacket show, it's just...
I haven't.
It's incredible.
I do dig their music.
Yeah. So I've been really fortunate.
Yeah. I mean, that's just, that is, you know, people can only wish for a career, you know, to cover all those bases that you have. I hope you, the gravity of what you've experienced is registering with you and that you do appreciate it because...
I'm incredibly grateful.
Yeah.
Incredibly grateful for all of it, that I still have a career, that I've worked with so many amazing artists, have successfully avoided many of the pitfalls. I've only been on a couple short tours that were just crummy. Usually they've been just great. And as you pointed out at the very beginning, I've been fortunate enough to just like not get pigeonholed in a genre. Not only did I work for Barry White and Barry Manilow, I did those tours, I think, back to back. And these were both when I was mixing front of house.
Yeah.
So I was... Yeah, you know, every day I'm just like, wow, how did I pull this off? And boy, am I grateful for all the successful and great experiences I've had.
And you mentioned Barry White. I want to kind of dig into that for a second. You know, when he was touring at the time that you were doing front of house, he had, you know, basically an orchestra with him, correct? You know, a string section at least. And
it was a full
band.
Yeah, no, it was an orchestra.
Yeah. I mean, so how was that? I mean, the scale of something like that. I saw in your notes that you had over 70 inputs for the console with all that. So that, in especially in those days, this is what, like late 80s, I think.
Yeah.
How did you approach that? I mean,
I loved gigs like that. Somehow I ended up doing, maybe because I had a little bit of musical schooling. In high school, I took music theory and just knew a little and bought some of those big, thick Norton scores when I was a kid and would listen to classical music and follow along. Mm-hmm. I had at least a rudimentary understanding of instruments, what they sounded like, how they blended together, how they worked together. And so I ended up with a few gigs that involved large string sections or symphony. And Barry might have been the first, but it was just great. And to go back to that thing about 70 inputs, I should probably take that off my resume. It's like 70 inputs by today's standards is nothing.
But
in
that
an
day,
era where a giant console, I mean, the biggest console you could imagine had 40 inputs. I mean, I did literally have two consoles set up in an L so that I could have all those inputs. It was just great. There's so much to work with. You know, there's nothing more fun than taking a four-piece down and dirty band where nothing is competing with anything else sonically and just getting everything in your face and making it sound making it sound amazing and impactful. But there's also the challenge of having something that requires more finesse and making decisions, certainly in the live environment, of how you EQ and treat and process certain instruments that if listened to out of context might not sound quite right, but work in the context of a Barry White show.
Yeah.
It was great. I loved it. We did some amazing shows. We did Royal Albert Hall, and I think that was the first time I ever mixed a show at Royal Albert Hall in London, and that was fun.
That's crazy. Well, you know, we've talked about all these artists, amazing artists that you've worked with over the years. Is there anybody that you haven't worked with that you know, would be kind of the dream gig?
I've thought about that because I've heard that question before, and I have to be honest, I don't really have a long list. And I guess the reason is there are lots of artists that I still want to see and that I would like to see again. Mm-hmm. But I also know enough about what I do for a living to know that enjoying an artist does not necessarily mean that I would enjoy working for them. there are a number of artists that I have worked with that I hope to return to work with. I mean, I did a bunch of stuff very, very early in Fiona Apple's career. And then I left to go do other things. And I've been fortunate enough to come back and do a handful of shows now. And like once every couple of years, I'll get brought in to do something. I hope that she tours again. Not only is she an artist that I admire amazingly, she's someone that I consider, I mean, a friend, might be exaggerating a little bit, but I enjoy her company. And I like her very much, having nothing to do with music, but also mm-hmm. having everything to do with music. So that's one that I'd like to return to.
Yeah.
But yeah, it isn't like I have a wish list that I'm trying to make my way through. And it's an interesting point, at least I think it's interesting. There's a couple that I've successfully avoided. Mm-hmm. Like when I got called to mix for a house for Prince, I respectfully declined because that's just, I mean, I just felt like I didn't have the kind of character to make my way through that. I applaud all the amazing engineers, and boy, there have been a lot of them who've yeah. made their way through that gig, some more successfully than others, you know? Yeah. But for me at that time, it was like, life's too short to yeah. be tortured. And it didn't feel like this is a nut that I have to crack. I mean, I've had moments of like that in my life yeah. where it's like, yeah, man, this is a challenge and I'm going to rise to the occasion and I'm going to whoop this thing.
Yeah.
It's like with Prince, I was like, I'd rather just admire that from afar. Thank you very much.
Yeah. No, I've heard several stories in that regard, you know, either in the studio or live where he can be, you know, or could be in his day, a little challenge to work with. So, you know, creative genius for sure.
Politely, yes.
you know, it comes with its challenges.
Yeah.
One last question, and you know, you've probably heard this one in previous shows. If you could go back to a young 17, 18-year-old Paul back before you really kind of launched into this career, is there any piece of advice you would give yourself, knowing what you know now, that would either help you out or change course a little bit or just make things smoother?
It's a great question, John, and I have in fact given it some thought. And I guess what I would say is, if you'd asked me that question 20 years ago, I would probably have a list of things that I might come up with. At this point, not only in my career, but in my life, I've come to understand that who I am, and I'm reasonably happy with who I am, both in my work life and in my personal life, that I'm here really because of everything that I've encountered. And that includes the failures, the missteps, the regrettable decisions, the things that required apologies, the things that I can never really make up for fully. This is really more in my, you know, in like personal stuff than
sure.
than work stuff. But I'm here because of every last one of those. There has been some suffering. I wish I could have avoided it, but I wouldn't be who I am if I hadn't have gone through that stuff.
Exactly.
So yeah, I'm just, you know, again, not to sound like a boring old dude, but man, I'm just really grateful for what I have. Hopefully, I have some more to offer to the mm-hmm. people that wish to hire me, and that I can be of service to all these great artists that I've been able to work with.
Yeah. That's a great answer, because everything that you experience in your life, good or bad, is what develops you as a person and shapes your life. So if you changed one, you know, it's like all those time travel movies where, you know, if we change one little thing in history, it's going to yes, throw indeed. Everything off.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's kind of true to a degree in your life. You know, if you did go back and say, well, I wouldn't do this because this was a horrible couple of years, whatever, then that wouldn't result in, you know, everything else that happened. So I always ask that question just because, you know, sometimes people have some good, you know,
suggestions. There have been some interesting answers in the life of your podcast, for sure. Yeah. There have been some interesting stuff.
And everybody's got their own journey and knows where the skeletons are hidden and where where they're not. So, well, Paul, it's been great chatting with you. Really, really enjoyed your stories and your illumination of your career and your experiences. Where can people follow along with you either online or on social media or anything to see what you're up to?
Yeah, you know, I about 5 years ago, I realized that Facebook was just giving me no joy whatsoever, so I quit. And I've now left both Instagram and Twitter as well. Okay. I might return someday, but it's just, you know, it's not working for me, and it's kind of a cesspool, and they mine our data, and it's just ugly. So, in answer to your question, if you go to my company website, which is reverse-thread.com, there's some stuff about me, and I did start a photo blog because I missed the Instagram experience. So,
yeah,
I try to keep up on that. But otherwise, yeah, that's about it.
Yeah. No, that's perfect. It's one-stop shopping there, and people can go and see it all without all the other garbage that we encounter on social media. Yeah, and I did check out your site, and I love your dog poop street picture, which is fascinating.
That's my neighborhood, so, life in New York.
I can relate. Well, thanks again, Paul, and it's been a pleasure talking to you, and all the best in everything, and hopefully, you know, as things start to get back on track here, you can get out and start doing some more shows. And
fingers crossed. Thanks for having me. I really love what you've done so far. I hope the podcast continues. And, you know, an honor and a privilege to be here. Thanks, John.
Thank you, man. And thanks to all of you for listening to another episode of Beyond the Spotlight. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening to Beyond the Spotlight. If you like what you heard, please share the show with your friends. You know someone who'd make a great guest? Get in touch through our Facebook page or email us at beyondthespotlightpodcast@gmail.com. And however you download or stream this, hit subscribe so you don't miss any new episodes. I'm John Diener, and this has been Beyond the Spotlight.